think we might just get started so that we have an opportunity to field as many questions as possible. My name is Dulciana Samaria Brash. I work with the Pacific Institute of Public Policy based in Port Vila. I'd like to firstly to say thank you to Professor Stephen Howes for the invitation and certainly the opportunity to be chairing such an important session today. Through the couple of days that we've seen economic updates and more recently the political updates have given a significant roundup and I hope a clearer picture of what's happening in Papua New Guinea considering our considerable growth and social and economic changes. Today on our panel we'll be three speakers with different views on starting with Joe Chandler. I'll introduce them all at once rather than individually. And if we can take questions individually as opposed to batching them like we've been doing in the previous sessions. So firstly, please welcome our panellists today. Thank you. Joe Chandler is a journalist and a writer and an author, an honorary fellow at the Alfred Deakin Research Institute, and also a lecturer at the Monash University School of Journalism and Australian Studies. She also contributes to the Global Mail and an honorary fellow of the Alfred Deakin Research Institute, and is a winning correspondent. And Joe's done work widely reported on human rights, development, environment, science in Papua New Guinea, sub-Saharan Africa, Australia, Antarctica, and Afghanistan. I'll just introduce everybody now, and I'll ask the ladies to come up as and when they're ready. Dr. Kamalini Lokuge is an ANU fellow based at the National Centre for Epidemiology and Population Health. She additionally works as a doctor and a medical epidemiologist for international health organisations, including Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, the World Health Organization, and the International Committee of the Red Cross. She's an award-winning... she's awarded a Medal of the Order of Australia in 2010 for service to humanitarian aid from 2010 to 2012. Kamalini was also a member of the MSF Australia Board of Directors, and she's currently a research development advisor to the MSF in the UK. Speaker from Papua New Guinea, who's been engaged in law enforcement for the last 22 years, will hopefully give us a realistic inside view of the difficulties, certainly the difficulties of law enforcement, the implementation of law enforcement in Papua New Guinea. Senior Sergeant Kathy Rimbaugh is with the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary. As I said, she served for 22 years in both rural and urban settings in Papua New Guinea, but significantly, she works in Leh, Papua New Guinea's second largest city and biggest industrial centre that links the highlands to the Momase, so certainly the coastal regions to the highlands. So it's been a difficult area, and hopefully Kathy will be able to give us some interesting insight. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, everybody. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to come here today, and I'll just check the time before I start. Is that okay, Steve? I'll just perhaps start with a little bit of background about the kind of journalism that I've done and I'm doing. And this talk will ramble a little bit across, trying to give you, I guess, a sense of the media landscape and how that's changed and what that means for reporting on complex issues from complex areas like Papua New Guinea. And how perhaps some of you as in your roles as academics, researchers, activists with NGOs, might be able to help contribute to having a healthier, better informed media discussion about issues like violence. I'm also grateful for the pictures that I'll show today. I'm good with words, or I like to think that I'm okay with words. I'm terrible with a camera. So I've borrowed some photographs from my friend and colleague, Vlad Sokin, who some of you might know. He's done some extraordinary work documenting violence in Papua New Guinea, a project called Crying Mary, which has been exhibited quite a bit around the world in the last year or so. And he's quite an extraordinary photojournalist in his own right. He's currently doing a lot of work documenting police brutality as well through the Pacific for the UN. So thanks to Vlad for some of these pictures. In the last couple of years of my journalism career, and I've spent 20-odd years with The Age, and these days I work as a freelance, unlike many journalists who have jumped the sinking ship of old newspapers. So the last few years of my career has really sadly coincided with the death throes of old media and newspapers. But I tried, I guess, to focus while I could, while there were still some resources and some possibilities within newspaper budgets and newspaper constraints, to do what the old broadsheets used to do so well, which was to try and tell really rich stories about fascinating places and realities. And increasingly I found a couple of areas were particularly neglected, and I thought I may as well jump in and see what I could do in those areas. One of them related to climate change science, a lot of discussion often around carbon prices and carbon policy, but surprisingly little about actual scientific work on the ground, where the data comes from, and what I thought was the fascinating story about the individuals of where, how do they gather up this information, where do they go, you know, the ends of the earth that they visit to collect the data and to tell the stories about how the planet's changing. And the other area was really human rights and health and public health issues, disease, in remote parts of the world, which were often difficult to get to. And I guess as editorial budgets shrunk and editorial ambitions within newsrooms began to kind of diminish, a lot of these bleaker, more confronting stories kind of fell off the radar, and we went for the low-hanging fruit of last night's edition of MasterChef or other compelling issues of that realm. So in those last few years, I guess old age and cunning are quite under-recognised attributes in the newsroom, but I employed both to try and get out to a few interesting places in the last few years. It meant that I got to look at some quite challenged locations around the world and aid and development projects on the ground, which I guess began this sort of layering of experience and observation which you bring with you to every new location of to be able to see some context. How does what I'm seeing in Port Moresby compare to what I've seen perhaps in Mozambique or in Melbourne or in Maputo? So you start to get this kind of what I would hope is a kind of a landscape of knowledge where you've got some riches that you can dig into and some experience where you might be able to bring questions and perspectives to what you're seeing that will make it a little bit more alive and perhaps bring some integrity to the project of telling the stories that you encounter. I have to admit that as I was looking in this, in the area of looking at health and educational and economic indicators, when I became interested in these things globally, I kept seeing often Papua New Guinea sitting at the wrong end of those tables. And I realised that I knew pretty much nothing about the place. Despite the close historical, geographic, political and increasingly the share market ties between our nations, there was very little substantial reporting coming out of Papua New Guinea in recent years. Generally, what you would have would be some sort of crisis or meltdown occur, at which point editors would scramble to put people on planes and get them visas and go and cover this flashpoint. Generally, that always involved men in suits, men in uniforms, men with guns. Very rarely did you see women in that landscape of at all, unless they were sort of, you know, the file footage looking downtrodden between scenes of people chesting each other over whatever the power dispute was at the time. So I guess I began to wonder about how we might crack into some of those landscapes that were so hidden. Today there are only two full-time Australian correspondents working in PNG, whereas when I started my career there were still probably three or four attached to major mastheads who were full-time correspondents and had a real knowledge of the country. and were able to sort of, I guess, bring their wisdom and their contacts and their insights to make sure that we had a fuller story told to us about what was occurring there. And what we have now is really this crisis-driven model. And we don't get to see the context. And I guess it's context that I'm really concerned with. Pictures like this by Vlad Sokin can indeed speak thousands of words, because you look into someone's eyes and you really get a sense of their humanity. You look at the things around them and the location where they're photographed, and you get a sense of the reality, the grittiness of the environment in which they live, their context. And I guess what beyond that, though, who is this girl? Where did she come from? How did she come to be beaten? Why was she beaten? And that's when putting that picture within the framework of words becomes more and more complex, and that's really the challenge. To me, the kind of journalism that I find really appealing as both a consumer and that I aspire to work on as a reporter is all about digging about that search for context. And it's a bit of an imperfect sort of eternal quest. But you don't have if you don't have a crack at it, the stories that we tell about, share about Papua New Guinea will always be sort of hollow and meaningless. They might horrify, they might appall, but are they doing more harm than good unless we can talk about the context in which this reality exists and then where it might go, where does the conversation go, what do we do with the knowledge that we take from that story? I think that these pictures and these stories are really important because it's about connecting realities and teaching something about ourselves and our reality and informing us about something about the process of learning about those remote realities tells us about ourselves, tells us about the way the world works, and ultimately it might provide us with the information to yield some kind of response. Strong storytelling is really hard to do because it takes time and it takes care, not least because of the mire of things like informed consent and of exploitation of the people that we photograph and interview. Really, they're very incredibly generous and incredibly trusting in giving us their stories and allowing us to photograph them when they're often at their most vulnerable in order to communicate their stories authentically. In our media landscape, as we go through this period of upheaval and the old newspaper model collapses because it's no longer got the money flowing through from advertising which supported the old journalism practice, with that all collapsing, it's very difficult for newsrooms to find the resources and for editors often to find, I guess, the nerve and commitment and guts to run stories carefully, thoroughly, deeply, and to continue the conversation, not just to do the hit and run, but to follow up with more stories, what's happened, what has failed to happen. Complex, important storytelling challenges both the writer and readers because there are not neat endings or clear beginnings as to where it all came from, and there are not easy answers. To tell these stories authentically out of places like Papua New Guinea, you literally and metaphorically have to find a path through the jungle, through the settlements, over mountains, across the sea, the sort of adventuring we heard about this morning from those the young men that were doing the survey work down in Gulf Province and up in Enga. These are really difficult landscapes to get across, but we need to take our readers through those realities and then sort of have them sit down in the village and introduce them to the people who can tell them about what's actually going on here. The perspective, though, that I have to make clear here is that I'm an Australian journalist writing largely for an Australian audience, commissioned, when I'm lucky now, as a freelancer, by Australian editors. So when I tell stories out of a place like Papua New Guinea, I'm trying to introduce readers to their neighbours. I'm presuming that they don't know them at all, and often that's a pretty fair assessment to begin with. And I'm trying to take them inside their world, and this is an exercise that's fraught with lots of pitfalls and difficulties. The ugliest traditions of this kind of journalism were perhaps most memorably captured in the memoir by one English veteran foreign correspondent who called his book, "Anyone Here Been Raped and Speaks English?" This was memorable because of what it really said about the kind of transaction that occurred in these landscapes when foreign correspondents heard about some sort of crisis, heard that, you know, violence, abuse, warfare, some sort of a fallout had occurred, and they're walking into that landscape and very imperfectly trying to gather up the evidence that they might present to their readers back home. But as I said, it's a very imperfect model. But the truth is that sometimes field reporting is still very much shaped by that kind of hurried, raw imperative to get to the story fast. And it's often taken over and shaped by the two or three people with the loudest voice, the best English, and perhaps the most at stake in a discussion. So you can very quickly find that your efforts to tell an honest story from a remote place where you're pretty unfamiliar with the way the lay of the land falls is that you might find that you've been, you know, hijacked or taken up a particular alleyway in relation to the way the story unfolds that you might later discover was not as careful or thoughtful as it ought to have been. And I guess part of that is the message that I try to communicate when I talk to experts like yourselves and activists and academics and NGOs is that you can play a really, really important part in better informing this, in that a journalist out in the field may collect half a dozen extraordinary photographs or interviews, but they won't be doing their job unless they hit the phone and try to put those into context. So where you can't find the context yourself when you're in an unfamiliar landscape, you're going to be relying on people that have visited that landscape a lot to help you put the stories in the framework of something real and something useful and valid. I find this picture, just as an aside, really interesting because of two elements, not just the despair on this woman's face, but the humanity of the woman looking after her at that moment. And that's an aspect of the story that often gets lost too, care that people give to one another. And so you can look at a picture of somebody that's been abused, but to see that the tenderness, I guess, in that exchange between those people is an aspect of the story that's often neglected in the hurry to tell the worst of it, you know, the most confronting of it. So I think it's really important to be able to find the space with pictures and words to explore the bigger picture of the humanity, the efforts people are making themselves to look after one another within their own communities. To venture into a society that's as complex and rich and baffling as Papua New Guinea and presume an attempt to tell its stories is a pretty ambitious exercise. And I've spent many nights in pretty lousy beds in falling down shacks on busy roads in the middle of Papua New Guinea or in the middle of the bush in Papua New Guinea, waiting for the generator to fire up in the morning or for the roosters to shut up in the morning and wondering what on earth I'm doing there and how I can possibly bring some real eloquence and authenticity to telling this story. And how do I take it out of this location and communicate it, even with the luxury of a couple of thousand words that I might have now in an online newspaper, where I'm freed from the old word constraints that newspapers used to put on us. If you don't a little bit crazy when you start, you probably soon will be at the end of trying to tell these stories, because what you realise is you start to pull a thread and follow it, and pretty soon you're realising you're unravelling this whole incredibly intricate picture. So you start with a story about violence, or you think that you're starting with a story about violence. And in fact, the story that you're writing about is economics. It's about infrastructure. It's about the failures of education. It's about collapsing roads and bridges. It's about corruption. It's about law and justice and the failures of law and justice. So you can't tell a story that is about any of these women in isolation and the event that occurred to them, because they are, until you communicate their reality within the broader landscape, it's meaningless and it's hollow. Anyone can go and sit, as I've done, outside the emergency room at Taree or Mount Hagen or Goroka or Kundiawa or Port Moresby, and they can collect enough material and photographs to tell dozens of shocking stories. But what does it tell us? What does it teach us? What can we do with these stories? And I guess for the first story that I tried... Oh, actually, I've gone ahead of myself there. The first story about violence that I tried to pursue when I was in Papua New Guinea was actually up around Tari, where Medicine Sans Frontières had responded to an Oxfam report from memory which identified levels of social and domestic violence that were akin to a war zone. And I went there once thinking that I was going to be writing a story about tribal violence. But then as I began to talk to people at the hospital and to talk to local members of the community, I realised it was a much more nuanced story than that. And I couldn't really begin to touch it unless I understood the realities of the families and how they related to, you know, the history, something of the history of Hela. And you begin cracking open some of these sort of mind-blowing histories and cultural paradigms, and you feel yourself quite adrift often in these situations. But you can't tell the story about the violence that you see in a location like Tari Hospital until you put it in the context of cultural norms, history, and the arrival of the LNG. So all of these things have to be brought into the story to give the narrative any kind of integrity. I remember asking at the MSF team that were working on site there in Tari, and the surgeon had just come from the Swat Valley in Pakistan and the conflict there, and the nurse had just come from the Congo, from eastern Congo, where she'd been repairing women that were victims of terrible sexual violence across in Goma. And I said to them, how does what you're seeing here compare to what you've seen in those parts of the world? And they both told me that it was in some ways more horrifying what they were finding in Tari, because it wasn't ethnic violence, it wasn't one religion or faith or nation against each other, it was within families. And the same person that had caused the beating the night before was perhaps bringing the person in for treatment the next day. And they found this completely mind-blowing and very confronting truth to deal with. And I guess that's where my story had to begin, trying to unpick some of that for an audience that was a long way away and far removed from that reality. Bit by bit, over the repeat trips and listening and reading and re-listening to the interviews and going back to the experts, some of whom are in this room, you begin to, as I said, require a layering, and you begin to try to tell a story that's not just about the man who attacked his wife with a bush knife, or the girl who was gang raped, or the gang that tortured a woman in a public place. You begin to try and tell it within the story of history and culture and society, and you see it within the context of booze, drugs, despair, faith and the lack of it, infrastructure and the lack of it. And I guess that's where we begin to see some capacity for where the story goes next and how we might react or how we might respond in our distant reality. Quite recently, the story that I wrote on sorcery-related violence in Papua New Guinea... I seem to have lost that picture. This is the picture. This was actually the least confronting of the pictures of that particular attack that we were given. It sounds strange to say that, but the others were much worse. And we thought very carefully about how to use this picture. And it was appeared in the Global Mail with my story only a week or so after the attack at Mount Hagen, where the young woman was burnt at the stake. So there was a lot of discussion at that time about sorcery-related violence in Papua New Guinea. And I guess what I attempted to do with this story was to try and identify not just the horror of the particular incident, but then to go and try to put it within a framework of where has this come from? What is the history of this? Have these events always occurred? Are they new? How often does it happen? Is it just that the photographs are emerging now? These are all really big, difficult questions which academics will probably wrestle with for years to get to the bottom of. And we're attempting within the framework of a couple of weeks to provide a context for this. And I guess what I hope, if nothing else, that this story contributed was that it began a discussion. It's not the end of the story, it's the beginning of a discussion. About 1 million people apparently have viewed that story online. It's about 4,000 words. And because of the way the internet can now share information, it's borderless and it's boundless. it's very interesting to read the commentary that various readers have made. Clearly, a lot of them don't actually read all 4,000 words. Some of them don't look past the picture. But those that have wound their way through it, a lot of them want to know, what do we do from here? What difference can, you know, where do we send our $25 check? This is not that sort of issue, and I guess what we've tried to do is to follow up with some stories that discuss, you know, allow people like Dame Carol Kidu and people within, you know, bishops in Kundiyawa and other activists who are very close to these realities to talk about what they think it's going to take to address this in a meaningful way. And often they talk about generational approaches, about education, about investment in all those basic infrastructure things, that you can't fix a situation like this that quickly or easily. So what does that mean for an Australian reader that's sitting down and reading this story? Well, I would hope that what it might do is inform them in a way. It might inform their vote. It might inform the charities that they donate to. It might inform their choices as consumers. If they're young people, it might inform the kind of vocation or education or job that they aspire to and what difference they might make in the world. Or if they're my age or older, it might inform the kind of investments that they make with their money, where they put their superannuation, what power they exercise as a shareholder, so that they too can make some influence, that they can have some, I guess, response, humane response to the realities that are occurring in our neighbourhood and situations which we are involved with as you know, neighbours within the Pacific region. So I guess I'm a purist in a sense that I really believe that sharing these stories and trying to dig deeper than the flashpoint crisis headline provides real opportunities for Australians to gain a better understanding of Papua New Guinea, and from Papua New Guineans who end up being exposed to these stories now too. And when I write these stories, when I'm really brave, I put them on Sharp Talk and then I wait to see what happens. And to get that two-way exchange of information with Papua New Guineans to allow them to jump in and respond to how I saw the story, to have to defend myself against what they might say, the concerns they might have. When they raise, often I will find that it will shape the way I approach the next story because I've grown and evolved a little bit and learnt more from what their response has been to the story. And hopefully every time we have this exchange, the story becomes a little more rigorous, a little more authentic, and hopefully eventually more meaningful and have more impact. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much for the excellent insight into the local context, of particularly of the images and the editorial parameters that you face at home. I know that in Papua New Guinea, for the longest time, our authorities tend to be cloak and dagger about allowing journalists to come in to share what our challenges have been and some of the constraints, development constraints are. So it's important, I guess, for audiences to hear the inside story, but also from our perspective, from a human, distinctly human rights perspective. And I have to apologise, everyone. I didn't introduce the papers individually in my excitement to get to introduce the ladies adequately. So, yeah, the main thing to say is that I guess from a PNG woman's perspective is that we see the media images abroad and internally, but the internal and real risks for us are daily. It affects our professionalism. It affects our capacities to be good mums and real mums. It affects all of our relationships. And, you know, there was a time when all of us feared what the international media were going to say about our country. But I think it's to get an inside view, it's very important, and thank you. Now we have an institutional perspective from Kama Lini. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to the Development Policy Centre for asking me to speak here today. And my presentation is to follow on, particularly one thing Joe said, on what can we do now. So this is a bit of a story about what can we do now. I'm an academic and a researcher, so I try to hold on to objectivity, very often unsuccessfully and totally unsuccessfully around this particular issue. But I'm going to start with how I first was exposed to the issue of family and sexual violence in PNG, and then the story of responding as a researcher, as an individual. So in October last year, I went to evaluate the Family and Sexual Violence Support Centre, so the Family Support Centre in Angau Hospital in Lae, Papua New Guinea. At the time, that hospital had been supported by Médecins Sans Frontières, so Doctors Without Borders, for about 5 years. And over that period, they'd seen about 13,000 to 14,000 survivors of family and sexual violence. And the objective of that program, when MSF started the support to the centre, was to achieve high-quality medical and psychosocial care for those survivors. And that objective had been achieved. So for the around 3,000 survivors who presented each year, and I'm going to say women and children because the vast majority were women and children and are women and children, they received good quality, appropriate medical and care and counselling. But two things particularly from my evaluation that I couldn't let go of was that the majority of the women who presented were women who had been injured, had been raped, had been assaulted by their partners, so intimate partner violence, intimate partner rape. And the majority of non-intimate partner sexual assault and rape that presented, the cases were children. So those two things are facts. I want to now talk to you a little bit to illustrate what those facts mean to service providers. So these three women are women who deal on a daily basis with this issue. Is this a point in my brain?
Yes.
So this is Daisy Planner. She is the coordinator for the MSF project. She's a social worker from the Philippines with many years. I first met Daisy in Uganda in 2006, working in the camps there. This is Ivan, one of the MSF nurse counsellors, and this is Leonie. Leonie is a policewoman. She's the juvenile officer for the sexual offences squad in Lae, Papua New Guinea. And why I took this picture was because that day, these three women had been dealing with a particular case, a young woman who'd been abducted at the age of 17, 2 years prior to her presentation here. She had been held captive in a room for those 2 years, had been regularly beaten and raped. She had had a child, and at the time she presented, she had one 10-month-old child and she was pregnant. She had escaped and come to the FSC for care, which they had provided medical care, and then she was transferred to a safe house in Lae. So this was the safe house she went to. It's run by a very good individual, a man with his family. It's in one of the least secure settlements in Lae. So this is the safe house, what they call a safe house. It's a small building. There is a training centre for children there. It's open. The fence doesn't provide security. There is no security guards. Very soon, people know who is there, what is happening, so the man, the individual who had abducted this young woman, became aware she was being held there. He came, he had a gun. So she was taken back to the FSC because that was the family support centre. That was the only place people felt they could take her. They took her there. He came there with the child and with the weapon, asking for the girl to be returned. The Family Support Centre staff contacted the police initially, the Criminal Investigations Department. Officially, they were told there's not much we can do, we're not clear on what this story is about. Unofficially, they were told, you know, it's risky for you to keep that girl in the FSC, you should probably send her home, which to them was unacceptable. But over 5 years of providing medical care, what has happened is that de facto these staff have realised that medical care is not the end to these particular problems. They have built relationships on an informal basis with people in the sector they trust. And so that's why they called Leone. So she's the juvenile officer. She came. She spent a long time talking to this girl. But still, no one knew exactly what to do. She wasn't originally, her family wasn't from Lae. She couldn't go back to the safe house. The safe house manager was saying it's not safe for me or for her to return. So that is the experience for people delivering services, trying to help these women and these children. And it's within a context, you know, you hear a lot about the justice sector, and there have been very many good things, that programs that people have tried to put in place. This lady, she's very committed individual. She's one of the female village court magistrates. Her name is Rose. And to give you an idea of the importance of this village court system, the more common law system in PNG, it's now part of the recognised legal system. It is intended to hear non-criminal, fairly small matters, but because of the delays and the issues in accessing justice through the formal sector, a lot of justice, even for these women and children, happens at this level. So Rose was saying, for example, the Lae Court would issue maybe 6-7 interim protection orders a month. This is Rose with her official stamp. She sees, as part of her court, a weekly session with 5 others, she sees about 40 cases, and she told me a lot of them are family and sexual violence. And she says, I know I shouldn't be seeing cases such as rape of children, but often the families have no other option. They can't access the formal system. They come to me for some kind of justice. So I see children who have been raped, and I need to decide, what do I do? Do I look for a way to compensate? Because the other sectors are not able to provide adequate recourse. So that's the setting in which many committed individuals are working. And I want to now move on to what is the gap? What is the problem for service deliverers? So you have people across all these sectors who are responding, who are doing their best, more than their best, at great personal cost. Many, you'll hear from Kathy, my fellow panel member, about what it means to be a policewoman trying to deliver services in a system that often is not just, you know, non-supportive, but can be obstructive. What we recognise in developed countries, we have similar problems. Everyone is aware of the case in America recently of women who had been held for several years. But the difference is that we have a system that we expect to respond. We expect justice. We expect accountability from our services. We expect that when something like this happens, there will be a response, that justice will be achieved in some form. And the key to managing complex family and sexual violence cases in any setting where the system functions is case management. And that is critical. It is about linking all sectors that are needed. So in Lae, there has been very strong focus, and there is very effective medical care, but it has not been supported by an equal focus and equal strength in other sectors that are equally important, in the justice sector, in the child protection sector. And so that has meant that the individuals here who are trying to respond are fairly isolated in those sectors. They are linked informally by connections to people who have asked them to help, who they know if they talk to, they may get response from, but there is no coordination. And a few weeks ago, Ume Wainetti, she's the head of the Family and Sexual Violence Action Committee in Papua New Guinea. It is the peak body that is pushing strategy and pushing action on this issue. She came to and gave a talk at the Development Policy Centre, and this is something she said. So, in response to that, because of what is happening, but also because of what is happening on the service side, that there are good people, that there has been strong investment in the medical and counselling sector, there is the potential to build a case management centre that will develop best practice, a model of best practice care, not just in Lae, but hopefully for the rest of Papua New Guinea. And why there is this opportunity is for a few different reasons. Last week, MSF handed over management of the Angao Hospital, of the Lae Family Support Centre to the Angao Hospital. And what does that mean? Angao has committed staff, it has committed resources to continue medical care, to continue some of the counselling, but what will fall apart is the informal case management that's been happening. So people will continue to receive medical care. What they won't get is someone who can take them to the district court. And again, this was happening informally. It was never an objective of the MSF program. It was done because the staff realised if they didn't do that, they were neglecting their duty of care. But it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to formalise this, to support it more, and to link, to have a formal structure that links the large number of survivors coming to the FSC to the other services that we know exist in some way in Lae. So after my initial visit, I spoke to colleagues here, and in February I went to Lae with Stephen House, and we spoke to a range of stakeholders, all of whom, again, identified this as a large gap. And the intention is, as you would have realised from that case I presented and from the cases that Joe presented, the need is not just for women or children to receive medical care, it's to receive this comprehensive care and to receive support in accessing that care. You know, women who have been abused by their husbands, they don't have resources. They can't pay the 20 kina needed for, you know, an IPO to be issued. They can't pay the 50 kinas for the police to go and pick up their child, fill the car with petrol to go and pick up their child if there is a custody dispute. They don't know what is needed at the court when they present for their IPO. They need that level of support if they are to get justice. And we think that by building this model, by building one what has already been achieved in Lae, we will set up a model that can provide best practice, that can provide evidence. You have this large volume of patients. Nobody else in Papua New Guinea sees this number of clients. It's several magnitude greater. And it provides a base to examine what do these women really want. It's again something that people don't understand, that these women have not been asked. Once informed of what their rights should be, what the system should be providing, what do they actually want from the system? What recourse are they looking for when they present for care? So this is an opportunity to get some answers to all those questions. But really, why this, not just me, many people think that this is the beginning of an answer of what we can do, is these individuals. So that case I presented of that young woman, it actually happened in February, the time when Stephen and I were in Lae. We had called this meeting of stakeholders, and it was the first time that this group of people had been asked to meet formally together. And the intention was to discuss in general issues around family and sexual violence. But because for all of us the preoccupation was what was going to happen to this young woman tonight, that night, what was going to happen to her. It was the FSC staff, you know, were at risk. Their safe house wouldn't take her. The police didn't know what to do. So we called this meeting to talk to people in general. Ended up being an informal or a spontaneous case management meeting. Many of these people were there. So I want to tell you who they are. This is Anna Raymond. She's the senior solicitor in the Lae National Court. This is Kathy Rimbaugh, who you will hear from. This is Martha Tamali. She is one of the community policing officers. This is Daisy, who I told you about. Leonie, the juvenile police officer with the Sexual Offences Squad. This is Sari Waru. She is a secretary of a new NGO that is setting up a new safe house. This is Lincoln Mender. He is the doctor for the Family Support Centre. He from National Department of Health. very committed, who has now taken on the senior FSV management role. This is Mark Serapico. He's the senior magistrate for the Lay National Court. Again, through 5 years of experience, these are all people we have established as being committed to this issue, who, when they are asked, respond. And this is Emily Bosky. She's the child protection officer for the Lay province. MSF, the FSC clinic, sends her about 10 children a week with child protection issues. She has one day a week to work on child protection. And, you know, none of the supports we would expect. The first time I met her, she said, "Kamalini, can you arrange some counselling? Because I think I'm traumatised from my work." Anyway, so these people at that particular meeting, and all we had done, as an academic, you rarely get the opportunity to do anything useful, and even more rarely do you see it come to fruition in front of your eyes. But all we had done was pay 100 kin, I think, to rent the Salvation Army Hall and ask these people to come. And for an hour, they discussed this case. And the outcome was that Leonie got three other police women. Initially, there was discussion, should we put her in jail for protective custody? Then everyone decided that might not be the best thing. They put her in Leonie's office under 24-hour guard. They, Anna and Emily and a couple of the other women went to the Metropolitan Superintendent, so the senior police officer, said, "You make sure there's a warrant issued," and he issued a warrant for the perpetrator. She was kept for 48 hours safe by Leonie, and MSF organised repatriation for that young woman to go back home. So that's why I think this is the answer. And what we are trying to do is support these people to achieve what they know what they want. They know how they will achieve it. All they need is a little bit of resourcing. They are asking for some models of what works to provide training and capacity building around what they should be aiming for. I know these people can achieve it. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to help these people to achieve, or to build on what they have already achieved. Thank you.
In relation to time constraints, we'll move straight on to Kathy, who will give us an insight into the challenges of law enforcement in this area of gender violence in Papua New Guinea. Thank you, Jo.
Sorry.
Thank you, facilitator. Thank you, the organizing committee. And thank you to Mr. House. I bring a word of appreciation from the Office of the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary, the Commissioner, for the initiative to, for the invitation for me to represent the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary and the PNG government. Thank you very much. As you have heard from the other two presenters, and a lot more has been said during the presentations, maybe yesterday and today, basing on gender base as part of developmental issues. Yes, I have worked in the policing arena for 20 years over, and I would like to do a short presentation and then overview, and then I will take you a bit into policing aspects on the difficulties, some of the constraints in addressing the issues of gender-based. Gender-based violence in PNG may have similarities in other Pacific Islands and globally, as we have all know that gender-based is a global and a very complex issue which no one will have an end result or an answer to end this problem until somebody else, an individual, begins to take ownership. It is indeed one of the major developmental issues, and it is most often the vulnerable who are the victims, as in the case of women and children. And even few men have also fallen victim lately due to the trauma that the woman had suffered for some time and begin to realize where a man falls victim. I will be talking here as a local citizen, as a Papua New Guinean, and the difficulties and the experiences that I have seen and felt with the victims and the perpetrators of gender-based. As you have known, Papua New Guinea has a diverse tradition and culture, and it varies from province to province. Bride price is also seen as an exception, a form of ownership by men. Traditionally, it was a form of recognition to reunite the men and women's clan and to maintain family ties. This has been misinterpreted by many who have now used bride price as a token of ownership, which is totally against the PNG tradition and culture. As you have seen some of the photographs that were taken, we have seen as one of the contributing factors would be bride price as seen to be power and control over, or indirectly ownership over life of a victim, especially a woman. Women are not usually in public and community decision making, even though they are the people who are most important support of the family unit and provides economic resources. Women have been expected to do women's work, such as looking after children and providing food. This contribution is invisible, not counted as something of value. Women all over the Pacific and other countries, as well as PNG, have been looked upon as inferior by men and seen unfit to take on jobs that are traditionally done by men. The effects of gender-based violence. Gender-based is still a very serious problem in PNG as to date, and we will still be injecting funds, and so many trainings and workshops will be conducted to find answers to ease the problem. It disables what should be harmonious relationship within the family unit and the community at large. It also has a lot of negative impact on the victim, family, province, and the country. It results from gender equality and discriminations. The violence is so frequent imposed on the women and even children adds up to physical, emotional, and psychological abuse. And you can see in the province that I am living and working in, we have a lot of children who have been victims of family sexual violence, who are leaving their homes and they're taking up shelters with their peer, and they're even residing elsewhere where they're not supposed to be. Gender-based also violates significant dimension of human rights and denies the rights of a woman. Violence against women will continue unless effective measures are taken to eliminate the problem. Thus, this is crucial for everybody to work together to put a break on this ugly problem so that we have a healthier and more peaceful home and society. Gender-based and the policing itself. In PNG, as many of you may have known, or maybe you have heard, there is no specific law for domestic assault. It is classified under general assault summary or grievous bodily harm under the criminal code. So up until to date, there is still no specific law for any forms of violence against women or children. The issue of protection order for victim is still an issue in the country, and it is progressing very slow and at times put victims at a very greater risk from court and the police. So because of the alarming increasing rate of the victims of violence who needs to seek security and safe transit from the perpetrators, we have established a very good contact with our district courts to establish preventive measures just a temporary protection order for a victim who urgently needs that order to be in place. But the progress is still very slow, and there is no specific protection or safe house transit for the victims in some centers of PNG. The centers that are providing safe transit are sometimes at risk due to perpetrator or relatives forcing to take back the victims home. As you have mentioned, and you have heard policing, there is still a lot more yet to be done. Despite the policy, the legislation that have been put in place, and we still have a lot more yet to be done in terms of logistic supports, administrative supports, where we have the concentration around the family sexual violence unit itself. The office that in the center that I am working in, and I also did a couple of research in the other provinces, and you can see that the environment itself is not too conducive for our victims, and there is no privacy, and the office itself is not too conducive for such services delivery. And the other main hindrance would also be that because the family sexual violence, which was established under the law and justice to achieve the missions and objective of the government of the day, you will see that from my own perspective, I could see that there is still misinterpretation on the gender-based violence issue. We have, because we still have this great norm that gender-based is still a family issue. And woman deserves to be beaten if she steps out of line. You know, this is one way to get in line. I will go on to the PNG Constitution and the United Nations Treaty, which Papua New Guinea is also a signatory to the United Nations Treaty. And PNG's Constitution is basing on fundamental basic rights. You know, people have freedom to live, access basic health services. PNG will be liable to the United Nations if this is not followed. And we women will be continuously to be arrested, beaten, raped, murdered, burnt alive, and will continue to suffer in the hands of men. That's for some men, and many men have also improved their lifestyle, and they begin to support the program of gender-based violence awareness. And then we have talked on, and you have seen a couple of shots that was been put up by Joe on the end result of how much pain can be inflicted on a victim. And I would say that in the province that I am living and working in, Leh, which is the second city to PNG, we have seen a lot of changes have taken place in working, in establishing that network and partnership. The policy in the province that I have lived and worked in, we have established a very good networking with the public sectors, the business houses, the court, churches and NGOs, and we have a very good effective networking in place. And as you have heard from Kamalini, yes, we have a very good support from the magistrates, and we are also looking into getting a 24-hour protection for our victims, depending on the nature or the seriousness of the situation that they are in. We have had a lot of achievements from the law and justice, which have enhanced our capabilities in skill buildings and all this, and some of the other programs that were initiated, which have, you know, given the skills to our members, especially in policing, to seriously address the issues of gender-based violence. And I would say here that the last information sessions that were being attended by the police officers were like some 5 years from now. So, you know, changes have been taking place, so we need to have more information to be imparted to not only the police officers, but the other, like, village court magistrates and the other community leaders. The constraints that we have had so far, the medical services for the gender-based victims after hours, as Kamalini has mentioned, we have a safe house that is in operation, but it's not too safe in security-wise. And the gaps that we are lacking very much is we have a lot of services that have been provided with all other stakeholders trying to address the seriousness of gender-based, not only gender-based, they also relating to other cross-cutting issues like HIV, alcohol, and drug. And our weaknesses would be the monitoring and the evaluation aspects of trying to keep our records updated and then who is doing what and all this. That is also for police as well. A way forward, we are still trying to keep on to lobbying for a legislation that is from the political point of view, but you know, it takes the NGOs and all the other stakeholders to, you know, to keep on pushing to make this a legislation for domestic violence to be effective. And then we have to have a law of its own to seriously address the issue of gender-based. Working to create service centers for people with disabilities who are also, we also have victims who are people living with disabilities, special needs. Many also are victims of violence regardless of their status, either it be a male or a female. And there is still a great need for advocacy in policing, especially as well with other stakeholders, for as I've seen through the presentation of many of you have done today, that we still have a lot yet to be done in the remote areas of Papua New Guinea with respect to gender-based and other issues that you have all been presenting this morning. And maybe police officers to be multi-skilled. So whether I would give a classic example, if an officer who is in the traffic division and then is, you know, he has multi-skilled, is multi-skilled to address the issues of gender-based, whether it be gender-based or HIV or alcohol and drug. And to conclude, every individual group, community, nation, and the country, regardless of status, color, race, nationality, we all have to contribute by putting our hand up to be an agent of change for a better tomorrow for our children generation. Otherwise, the cycle on all forms of abuse goes on and no one will find the solution to end it once and for all. Thank you.
Kathy, thank you very much. I think the thread that goes through that is that some cross-sectoral support, and obviously you've been working together between Dr. Kamalini and yourselves, particularly in Lae, to roll out important programs that obviously continue to require further support, and certainly the political will in Waigani to continuously endorse programs and mainstream the issues of gender that seem to be dealt in isolation so often as though they're unrelated to our economic and political problems. If I could just ask you all now to... We're directing single questions as opposed to the batch of questions, so if anybody would like to pose any questions, please.
Sharing just a comment with the media in terms of, I've seen you on Sharp Talk and everything, and I appreciate the way you've been able to, there's one incident where I saw how you were able to edit one of your stories online that day after you had some feedback from Sharp Talk. And,
An offensive headline on the story.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I thought that was really interesting, and it's something that we have never been able to do before with old media. You know, it's always been straight in the media telling us what we look like or what we're doing, whereas now we have that platform to actually communicate and have a dialogue and discussion before it goes out. So that's all I wanted to say. Yeah, thanks. It's great to be able to do that.
Yes.
I'm just building on that question a little bit. One thing that I hear about whenever I speak to talking unions about mobile phones and social media is everyone's worried about the impact of pornography and the impact of the technology on gender rights and social media rights. I'm just wondering if any of you have any opinions on that. Is it actually changing gender relations for better or worse? And if so, how? So I was making a question.
I've got an observation on it, but I don't know. It's more about how the social media has been used as a campaigning base really strongly and effectively in response to things like the Kapari Lenata, her terrible assault. So to see the momentum. I don't know what I gather. Your question might be more about the physical behaviours or sexual behaviours. Is that what you're asking about?
Well, what I was suggesting about Kapari and others' case is that was filmed. You know, the technology provided a campaigning base, but it also provided some sort of weird form, kind of engendered some other responses.
Yeah, and that case, I think, for years people had talked about incidents like that occurring, and what had happened in that instance, of course, someone's taken the photograph. It's happening more and more. That's what my pictures are, a similar thing, someone on the scene furtively taking pictures on their mobile phone and then spreading them about. They do raise some real issues about how you handle those images, and one of the concerns we had at the Global Mail about which pictures we ran and why we ran them were about how they would be received or used. I've was really appalled at the notion that there might be people out there somewhere that would get off on these pictures, so to speak. And I didn't want to feed that salacious kind of interest in it. So that was one of the reasons why we didn't use some of the pictures. Also because the woman involved had survived, and I felt like the last thing she needed where she rehabilitated her life was to come across those pictures of her at her most vulnerable, where her face was... Her face was covered, but her whole body was exposed. And that picture is appalling and confronting, but she's hidden from view to a degree, and we were quite mindful about that. But perhaps in terms of behaviours of young people, I guess, you know, here we have a debate about desensitising of youth through these terrible images. I'm sure the same concerns must exist in Papua New Guinea about desensitising to violence and objectification of women.
Is there anyone else with a... Peter? Could you introduce yourself and direct your question to individuals?
I've been asking a couple of questions before, so also there's some knowledge about me. My family, I'm Peter from the MSC Secretary. I've been there since we had a group. Yesterday we spoke about a related issue in terms of disempowerment of women. And I wanted, first of all, to thank you for the courage you have in speaking about this quite sensitive issue in relation to Papua New Guinea. But I think we need to acknowledge it's not only an issue that affects Papua New Guinea, it's got a broad application to the whole region. And I wanted to perhaps ask about, you've kind of reacted to the issues in relation to the victim. I think that's noble and decent. What about the holistic problem in terms of the issues around the perpetrators? Is there an attempt to try and address that apart from the laws that are there to deal with the perpetrators.
Kamaleni?
Okay. I think when MSF did the assessment in 2006, I remember one thing was there is many, many actors dealing with the victims of tomorrow. Our project will be about addressing the needs of the survivors of today. And I think everyone in PNG, but also other places, will know there's many people working on cultural change, behaviour change, and largely people can respond if they disagree, but largely and effectively. You can't change the behaviour of a perpetrator by putting up a poster saying don't beat your wife. But what you can do is support people like Kathy who are holding the system accountable to these individual women and children, and in some cases men, and demonstrate that even if there is almost normalisation of some of this violence, the systems that should be accountable are accountable. And I think that is one way that people externally can support change from within, by supporting the people who are responding. Rather than, I don't know if your question was around that, but I think there is many, many organisations, many programs dealing with these issues, but they seem to often focus on what are the drivers, how does it present? No one really comes to what is the solution. That's my...
Yes, please.
I am Tony Swan from the Bell Policy Centre. You're probably aware, a couple of weeks ago, there's a WHO report on the looking at across many data sets the incidence of gender-based violence. I noticed PNG wasn't in there, so I had a question about what data exists and do you have a sense of the incidence compared to similar countries?
So again, they are planning to use that same instrument. There will be a survey in PNG and some other Pacific countries looking at prevalence of intimate partner violence, of gender-based violence. There is data from different subpopulations, I think, but the discourse is that it is such a terrible problem, and when you read, often it comes down to case studies or fairly anecdotal evidence. Probably the largest data set is the one that MSF has, but again, that's facility-based, so it's not so much about prevalence. But there are various estimates. All agree it's quite high. But again, I think everyone agrees that it is a problem. And as you say, again, people move then from what's causing it to how well can we measure it? You know, I think there is, at some point, you've got to stop measuring and do something.
Yes, please.
I wondered whether you talk about the idea of at the political level, identifying a champion or creating a champion. I thought Carol King played a role. It seems like from the presentation that you have done here, the problem is still there and it's well entrenched. So I guess we are three female politicians at the political level. Maybe linking up with them and trying to find a political champion to drive finding ways to address the problem. From my experience, we also having problems working with other government line agencies, working together. We can go as far as what we are mandated to do, and I can give you a list of examples. And it's a big problem in Papua New Guinea. And sometimes we are told that, why don't we have a MOU so that we can facilitate working together. So I'm talking about the health department and the police. We are experiencing problems with the health department, with the transport department. So maybe it's something that you can think about.
In response to your first about a champion, so this organization we are supporting to do this work is a PNG organisation. It's based in PNG, it's registered there, and on the board is Umi Wainetti, who really is the champion for family at the national level for men sexual violence. So, and the other person is Eric Kwa, who is head of the Law Reform Commission. or local champions, but it's true, there are. It's good that there are many others coming. And for your second question about intersectoral cooperation, I think there has been, you know, there was the first strategy in 2001, then there was more in 2004, and there's many strategies and plans. And the question is operationalizing them. You know, a good example is the Picanini Act. It has been revised and re-revised. And when you speak to people like Emily, she said, oh, the first time it came out, I read it. But now every year there's a new thing, so I just put it on the shelf because it doesn't really help me. So operationalizing, again, is about supporting the people on the ground. You can have good plans in Waigani, but really it is the people on the ground who deliver services.
Okay.
Kathy, you want to say something?
Sorry, maybe we'll take a final question from Matt, please. Sorry, we've gone a bit over time now, and I guess the trick is not to give a Papua New Guinean the management of time here, but please go ahead.
My question is actually for Kathy. Thank you very much for a wonderful presentation. I wanted to ask, in your experience over 22 years, do you think that the problem of gender-based violence has gotten worse? And if so, when do you think it actually really begun to get worse?
Thank you. From my experience, for the pathway that I have walked since working closely with, formerly it was domestic violence, and then the name gradually changed to family, and then it's gender based, now basing on gender equality. And I would see that it's from my own perspective. I see that it's not getting like worse. You know, it takes a communication link between for you, if you are skilled in the issue of gender base, and you can be able to disseminate information to a perpetrator or a victim that can be able to understand the communication link with you, if you have the know-how. And I see the obstacle as there is still a major communication breakdown, where you see that people who are not skilled to be addressing the issues, like you're getting a simple illustration would be, you're getting a carpenter to do a doctor's job. That is where, you know, we see where the problem lies. And until such time, what I see in PNG as overall context, I see it's getting not far too worse. That's from my own perspective. I've seen, and there's another issue which I just want to add on, just over illustrating your question, the issue of sorcery. You know, I have done a little bit of insight on that, and you would see that sorcery is coming about to be an hidden agenda on the HIV virus, where people are not coming out to speak on the issue of sorcery. So they're taking it for granted just to cover up as a sorcery related. So that is something that, you know, the Papua New Guineans, you know, we need to really seriously look into that, to do more advocacy on the issue of HIV virus. It's a silent killer disease. So yes, for me, I see that, you know, it takes everyone to be an agent of change. And I know, if I can walk this far, I know things can change. Did I answer your...
Just on Kathy's experience too, just want to jump in, because what she's done is extraordinary. But and often the first point of call when you're walking into a new community, you'll go and, you know, try and find somebody that works at the health clinic or the hospital, somebody that's a local priest or pastor, try and find some local older people that will, you know, give you the lay of the land. And, of course, you'll try and find somebody at the police station who might be responsive to or concerned even about issues to do with violence. Usually you'll find half a dozen male police at the police station who are completely disinterested in the issue that is the biggest and most pervasive crime that's occurring under their noses, but because it's just a domestic. And that's not unusual. I mean, we had exactly that experience here in the Australian context for a very long time. And I remember, a few years ago, I helped Christine Nixon write her memoir. And she commented how she had to drag male officers kicking and screaming into the area of addressing domestic abuse because so often their view was, it's something that occurs within households, we shouldn't get involved with it. This was only 10, 15 years ago in the Australian context, and she kept saying, but it's 50% of the assaults on children, it's 50% of the assaults on women. How can you not respond to this? This is your job. But I thought Kathy was telling me she was given a vehicle recently or some time ago to help her with her work. And I've been to two or three other communities where they were given the same thing. Some donor agency has come in and given a vehicle to the family and sexual assault officers working there. And as soon as the handovers happened and the donors left town, the men take the vehicle and it's never seen again to the work that it was intended for. They tried to do that to Kathy and she just said, hand over the keys. And she's still driving the truck, so I think that's amazing.
Well, on that note, I'd just like to add a couple of quick points about the indifference that you've just spoken about, Joe, whether it's law enforcement or whether it's in other sectors or, in fact, just in other parts of our society. The social acceptance of really bad behaviour is really going to cause significant problems for us in PNG across the board. The out-of-court settlements and compensation are basinblo baimsem. That's a really big problem for us in PNG as well, because not only are we lacking, the case law isn't being built, there are no precedents being set or very few precedents being set, we're actually, victims continue to be victimised because the people in power are accepting money these challenges that we're facing, and certainly in the area of gender violence, that is such a key area that in fact has to be legislated and taken into account. And on that note, in terms of developments in laws, as part of the recent raft of laws in Papua New Guinea, I understand that they've been codified so that it no longer remains a domestic issue, that people who are witnesses can in fact report these incidents of domestic violence, which is a positive step forward. And also the comment, Dr. Manoka's comment as well, is in relation to having a poster boy or girl for the issue. I think that we saw in the last 10 years in Papua New Guinea with a related issue, the Office of the Development of Women, the resistance exists in cabinet and with many issues, unless we mainstream gender violence and domestic violence, the resistance will happen where the political will is actually required to make the difference. So on that note, please help me in thanking the panel. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to the panellists and to Dulcie for the excellent sharing and the concluding comments. I just want to say a few things as we come to the end of this conference, and I want to make 5 points before you head out the door, although I can't stop you heading out the door. First point, I thought this was a great conference. Now, I have, as a middle-aged academic and bureaucrat, I've been to many conferences, and I guess I've organised many conferences, but I'm very particularly proud of this conference. I just thought, I mean, I was obviously an organiser, so I am biased, but I just thought this was a really, you know, insightful, frank, stimulating, gripping conference. And we dealt with some difficult issues across a range of countries and sectors. And just the fact that there were so many people here, so many people turned up at 9 o'clock on Thursday, and so many people are still here 2 days later, I think. I hope that means you agree with me. Second, I want to thank the needed thanks. I want to thank all the speakers who gave, they were all great and disciplined, interesting presentations. I want to thank our chairs and the people who held up the signs to get you to all keep your time limits. I want to thank everyone who's come, both my colleagues, those who've come from government. Good to see so much interest from the Australian government and of course those who've come from the region, both speakers and other participants, and who've been willing to share your insights with us. Thank you very much. Of course, I want to again thank the sponsors, because that is critical. We wouldn't have this without the sponsors. The ADB, they've taken their banner, right? But the Asian Development Bank, Public Expenditure Management, TA, and the Asia Pacific Policy Studies Journal, in cooperation with AusAid. Thank you very much. Finally, and you know, perhaps at this stage most importantly, I want to thank those who actually made the conference happen. As you can imagine, this is a huge amount of work, right, for the conference. We had a very small team of people who actually made this conference happen. And where is Macarena? I can't see her with that light. There she is at the back, if you can stand up. And also Ashley and Jono. And with Matthew Dornan as well, who did a lot of work. I'm very fortunate we have a very dedicated, you know, very capable team that is driving this work. So thank you, all of you. Third, there is a dinner tonight for the speakers, those guests who've come from overseas. It's at the Lemongrass restaurant just down the Civic, 65 London Circuit. We'll pick you up at the hotel. But otherwise, it's 6:15. If you want to come along, I know there are people, you know, we haven't had a chance to talk yet. Do come. Feel free to come along. Maybe let me know. Just make sure we've got enough seats. But there's an informal dinner tonight if you're interested. Fourth, we'd like to get your views, you know, whether or not you agree with me this was a good conference. And we will be sending out any emails, you know, are welcome. But we will send out some sort of evaluation. So please give us your views. So we definitely want to do this again. And I'm sure we can improve it and make it better for you. And then fifth and finally, I mean, we have talked about the next conference, and I don't want to reveal any private information, but I think I can say with talks with PNG colleagues, we are looking at the next conference, having it perhaps in PNG, in Port Moresby, in collaboration with UPNG, possibly other partners. So we look forward to that next year. And that wherever it is and whatever form it takes, look forward to welcoming you back to the next Pacific and PNG update. And so thank you, everyone. And